This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
DIA's first ever BioVenture Day, presented March 2017 in Glasgow, Scotland, was designed to connect stakeholders critical to the success of BioVentures and designed to investigate if the current BioVenture paradigm delivers equitable return for patients, investors, and healthcare systems in Europe. These investigations included a panel discussion on innovative funding models, which focused on innovative cures, cures for rare diseases in particular.
I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the DIA Global Forum. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Joep Meyers of Life Science Partners in one of this panel's discussions. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Meyers, and welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks.
First, would you tell us a little bit about Life Science Partners and what you do?
Sure. So Life Sciences Partners, or LSP, we're an investor group with an exclusive focus on investing in the life sciences industry, both in Europe and in the U.S. We're a pretty broad group. We've been around for quite a long time. We invest as a venture capitalist as well as a public market investor. We invest in therapeutics, medical devices, molecular diagnostics, and related areas. We've raised 10 funds and mandates in the course of our history. Currently actively invest out of 4 such funds. Myself, I'm based in Boston. I've been with the firm for a little over 10 years now. I'm one of the partners at the firm. Before that, I did a PhD in molecular biology, and I was involved in corporate finance in the life sciences industry.
How do venture capital organizations fit between the scientific research community and the biotech business community in Europe in particular?
I'll approach that question from a slightly different angle. I would say that, first of all, a very important observation that I would like to make is that the quality of science in Europe is very much at par with the quality of science in the US. Given that our organization, particularly on the venture side, really focuses on that European scientific base, we know that very well. And it's often not completely understood, but it's a fact. If you look at scientific output, if you look at quality papers, if you look at the impact of findings, if you look at very important medicines today and you go back to where they were first discovered or where the mechanism of action was first discovered, you'll see in many instances that's in European institutes. The only big difference, obviously, is that the availability of funding to then turn that science into something that ultimately may benefit patients. I mean, the availability of such funding is much less in Europe as compared to the US, particularly historically. And the other big difference, I would say, is that the financial industry to then back the development of medicines from such findings, scientific findings, again, is much less available in Europe as compared to the US. And the biotech commercial industry, if you like, again, is much more mature in the US as compared to Europe. But the base, the scientific base, again, is at par. And that, for me, is a very interesting observation. If you ask how we then as LSP, as a venture capital and public market investor, how we position ourselves there is that, look, we have very active inroads into the high caliber institutes. We talk to them on a very regular basis. We spin out companies from high caliber academic institutes and then, you know, help or even create management teams around scientific findings, build companies over the course of their development, which can be many years, as you know, in this industry. Not only do we then provide financial support, but we also, you know, leverage our networks and stick with these companies for years. Now, that's something that you know, is typical, I guess, to a VC organization. And the only thing I would say is that in Europe, again, the number of VC organizations that actively do this in the life sciences space is very limited. But I do feel that the investor community plays an active role in terms of providing funding and expertise to bring scientific research, you know, to translate that into something that ultimately benefits patients. Does that give you an idea as to how I'm thinking about it?
Yes. I'm going to ask you, you know, given that the quality of scientific research and innovation in Europe is on a par with that of the United States, as you mentioned, what accounts for the gap in funding? Is it that capital is less available in Europe, or is the capital available but more reluctant to invest in scientific discoveries in the application to healthcare?
Exactly. The capital available to to fund the translation of excellent science into, you know, products, whatever you want to call it, is just much more limited. That's a fact. And why is that? Well, I guess, you know, if you look at it from the government side, the NIH or NCI budgets here in the US are very large. And there are some good initiatives in Europe to try to bridge that. There's another big gap that I identify in terms of, you know, there's quite a bit of seed funding and initiatives available for the earlier, very early phases of company formation. But then there's a big gap once you become a little bit more mature. And let's say you're a therapeutic company and you've done some discovery work, you've done some lead optimization, let's say you're a small molecule, and you're maybe about to enter full preclinical work, or you're just in the middle of that, or just before your first in man study. To get sufficient funding at that stage, which obviously requires more funding than the early stages, is tough. That's a fact. And we see that every day. To give you an idea, across the different funds out of which we invest, we see between 700 to 800 business proposals per year. 700 to 800 proposals per year, out of which we might invest in 1%, 1.5%. And that's not to say that the other 99% are bad, but, you know, even we, as one of the larger investors in this space, you know, we have finite resources, and that goes for all the investors. And so a lot of it falls by the roadside. And so some of these companies will tap into the US investor base. You see that more and more. You see, for example, companies doing IPOs on NASDAQ simply because there's much more funding available. It's very understandable. And that has been the case for a long time.
Is capital reluctant to invest in Europe as opposed to investing in the US? Put another way, is capital more willing, more interested in investing in US scientific translational science into products than they're willing to invest in Europe for whatever reason? And what might that reason be?
There is less capital available. So you're right. At the end of the day, bottom line, there is less capital interested to invest in this space. If you look again on from the investor side, there are many fewer investors such as LSB in Europe as compared to what's happening in the US. So yes, that's a fact. And I guess it's also fair to say that certain larger institutional investors in recent years have put less resources available for investing in the life sciences space. And I guess that's what we're facing, but that's nothing new. That has been the case forever. For investors who do focus on Europe, as you understand, it creates a bit of an opportunity because we can be extremely selective in the things we invest in, and there's very high quality out there. But I think fundamentally, this is an issue, and it would be great to have additional funding available, for example, from a European initiative to kind of boost this sector, because a lot is happening already, and particularly at the earlier phases, but this gap that I tried to describe, where you reach a certain critical mass, but you need more cash to take that over the hill and become, for example, a clinical company with a couple of products in clinical development, there's a huge gap there. And it's not only for private companies, it's also the case for earlier stage public companies in Europe, which have limited access to capital, and typically they're more advanced, right? So if you think about impact of things that they are developing, it tends to be more later stage, it's closer to patients, so the impact could be much bigger. And I would be a strong advocate of additional funding being made available, for example, by the European Union to bridge that gap, which is very apparent. And it's not just me talking. This is something that I hear from many of the CEOs of companies that I talk to that we invest in. They're frustrated about this. There's a gap in funding, and it needs to be resolved somehow. The luxury position, again, is that science is excellent, but this gap needs to be addressed.
In your opinion, what could be done? You mentioned the European Union funding could be increased. Are there other actions that you think need to be taken or could be taken to dramatically or meaningfully improve the situation in relation to funding innovation in Europe?
There are, as I said, there are already some good initiatives, but maybe a bit more focus could be given to that, not so much on the earlier stage side, but more on the later stage side, the space I tried to describe. And the other thing I think is very important is to be very demanding and selective of that money. I'll tell you what I mean by that. If you look, for example, at the VIB, the Flemish Institute for Biotechnology, you're probably very aware of them. They've been around for a long time. I think they're a highly successful group. And one of the reasons why I say that is because they, from the beginning, have been very selective in terms of the companies that they spun out from the VIB. They didn't do that many. They did like one, maybe two per year. That's it. But if you look at those companies and you look at what happened to those companies in terms of, are they still around? Did they do, for example, a successful IPO? Were they able to attract external money? Were they able to be sold to industry? All these things that you can objectively benchmark, they're amazing. they have been really selective and they back winning companies. Sometimes I feel that the initiatives that we do have in Europe, even though, you know, they're intended very well, they just get, you know, scattered too much. I would encourage for the allocation of the resources available to be highly demanding. And maybe this is a bit self-serving what I'm saying now, but you may need some investor expertise there because that's all we do the whole day. We're highly, highly demanding of any money we put to work. That's our job. And so that's another thing that I find could be done a little bit better, where the focus of the resources is a bit more, let's say, specific, very restrictive in terms of, you know, initiatives and companies that you back, but the ones that you do back, support them all the way.
Looking ahead 2 to 5 years from now, what impact will Brexit have on the biotech business community in Europe, do you think?
I have no idea. How about that? I have no idea.
Are you willing to speculate?
Yeah, I think if you can find somebody who really can tell you, then please let me know as well. Because I honestly, look, I think that there are some high quality companies. Now, are they really going to suffer from Brexit? You know, some of them might, I don't know, but the majority of them, I guess, if fundamentally nothing changes with those companies, they should still be able to attract capital from investors. And so, you know, I mean, it could be that, for example, it's going to be harder for such companies to recruit high quality employees. Well, that would negatively impact them. That would be a negative. But can I oversee today if that's going to happen or not? I don't know. It could be that, who knows, maybe there's going to be some protective measures that make, you know, doing business from a UK perspective a bit less attractive. But again, I have learned a long time ago not to speculate about things that I don't know anything about. So I just don't do that. But I feel that this is an international industry, the biotech. It's one of the most international industries, period. So as long as you don't have a significant impact on your ongoing business, it shouldn't harm you too much. And I would estimate that if there is a significant impact, let's say you're a company and you can no longer recruit high quality employees because they're reluctant to move to Britain. Let's say that that were to be the case. I think what's going to happen is that you'll move out of Britain. And that, you know, will have an impact on the company, but even more so on I guess, the biotech industry in Britain. But again, look, I'm not going to speculate on this. I feel that it's just something that nobody knows at this stage. Nobody knows how the process is going to go. Nobody knows what the deal is that we'll end up with once and if the Brexit is done. So no, I'm not. You're asking probably the wrong person.
Turning to another topic, can you mention specific technologies or innovations funded by European venture capital organizations that have improved the quality of life for patients in Europe?
Let me try to make that objective. If you think about current medicines that are having a big impact on the lives of patients, right? And we all know that a lot of those at some point came from small biotech companies and before that from high caliber academic institutes, right? And today they might be sold and marketed by large pharmaceutical organizations, but a lot of those things originally came from, you know, academia and then were transferred into small biotech companies, which are typically funded by investors and by venture capitals, right, organizations. So, you know, we should also be a little bit humble about our role as investors because, yes, we do provide capital, we provide our expertise and our networks, but, you know, it's the entrepreneurs and the companies that then kind of translate all of that and bring medicines closer to patients, or maybe even all the way to patients. So we play an important role, but we're part of an ecosystem. If you look at, well, take the biggest, or at least one of the biggest drugs, Humira, as you know, that came from CAT, Cambridge Antibody Technology, right? And if you go back, that came from academia. Look at Tecfidera from Biogen, that's a dimethyl fumarate that came from a German entity. I mean, there's so many entities where if you go back, even the large immuno-oncology assets, right? Like Keytruda came from Organon in the Netherlands, if you go all the way back. BMS's IO portfolio came from Medarex, which used to be a small company. So, you know what I mean? So there's,
yes.
I think actually, if you were to look at the current top 10 sellers, I would speculate or postulate that the majority of those things at some point were not developed internally within the pharmaceutical company that's marketing today. Gilead, same thing. That came from PharmAsset, right? Small biotech company at some point. Talking about
yes.
The Valdi now. So the contribution of the investors, because I'm trying to broaden this a little bit beyond just venture capital, because also public market investors play an important role. Farmasset, for example, so Vivaldi's originator company, that was a public entity when it was acquired, and a lot of public money went into the public market investors. So I guess, again, financially, but maybe also via networks, expertise, know-how, they contributed, right? But again, I want to position our role correctly. I think investors do play an important role. If you look at your year like 2015, as you probably know, if you look at the total aggregate amount that was invested into the life sciences space in a year like 2015, which was a very, you know, successful year in terms of fundraising, but you go above 100 billion. Those are not my numbers. Those are the numbers that BioCentury puts out. 100 billion in 1 year. Well, that dwarfs any pharmaceutical R&D budget, right? Which are typically what, 8, 9, 10 billion per year? It's a factor 10 larger. So, you know, assuming that that money is not just squandered and wasted, that does contribute, right, to the creation of new medicines or new therapeutics or, sorry, new devices, diagnostics, all these things that we focus on. And I think that's the role. Yes, I mean, quality of life for patients. Now, that's a bold statement, right? Quality of life to me is a very, you know, that's not an easy question to ask, because what's really quality of life? And it so much depends on the indication and the unmet need and the perspective of the patient and the doctor. But undeniably, in the past few years, in my opinion at least, we have seen some advances in this industry which have been amazing. Take Sovaldi, right? Notwithstanding the whole pricing debate, but the fact that you can now cure patients with a 12-week or, in certain instances, an 8-week regimen, patients that before the nukes were introduced, you know, were being treated with interferons, ribavirin, and then the protease inhibitors came on top. But even with protease inhibitors, you were looking at something like 50-60% cure rates. Now, even in the severe population, you can treat almost 100%. I mean, that is a giant leap forward, in my opinion, from a medical point of view. Again, I'm staying away from the pricing debate here. I'm talking about the medical benefit. If you look at immuno-oncology, right? And unfortunately, this only benefits a minority of patients. But still, if you are one of those patients who happens to benefit from let's take nivolumab, and you're at the end of the Kaplan-Meier curve, right? And we're looking at potential cures here for patients who were really sick. Those things do have a positive impact. Again, I'm trying to be very balanced here. I'm well aware of the fact that there are safety issues. I'm well aware of the fact that this doesn't help everyone, unfortunately. But undeniably, there's been a benefit, at least for some patients. So that's the one thing that makes me motivated as an investor. This industry really does have an impact. And quality of life, again, has a lot of different elements to it. And it goes, I don't like making blanket statements, but I do feel that, you know, the industry has progressed quite a bit. I also think there's quite a bit on the horizon still. But I also don't want to sell the role that we as investors play. We play a very important role, provide a lot of capital. We have a lot of expertise, but again, we're part of an ecosystem, and we as LSP...
You are enablers. You are enablers of that translation of technology into products. Fair enough?
Yes, but together with other stakeholders, right? Together with management teams, together with doctors, with patients, let's not forget about them, regulators, payers at the end of the day. I mean, this is an ecosystem, and that's why you mentioned this in the very beginning. I think this event we just had in Glasgow, I'll just give you my perspective. It's a hidden gem. It really is. This was a very nice setting where you guys managed to get different people with very different perspectives in a nice small setting, which I kind of like because it allows you to really, you know, informally talk to people. And the one take-home message for that event for me was that there's a lot of willingness between different stakeholders to engage. Yet we don't do it often enough. And at least from my perspective as an investor, I'm very open to it because I realize we're part of an ecosystem. I feel very strongly about the sustainability of this industry. And anyway, I just wanted to also congratulate you guys on the event. You really were able to bring different opinions together, and it led to some very fruitful interactions.
Much appreciated. Looking at the horizon then, as you mentioned, what technologies or innovations do you foresee emerging in the near future
as a result
of venture capital investment in Europe?
Ah, come on, there's so much. I mean, I already touched upon immuno-oncology. We're just scratching the surface there, right? We've launched the first checkpoint inhibitors, and we're looking at these tons of combinations, and a lot of that will all materialize in the next 1 to 2 years. And we'll see what the best are, maybe a bit more, but we'll see what the best combinations are. There's so much to be done there. Take, for example, specifically Europe. And for all disclosure, I'm an investor. LSP is an investor in this company. But look at something like Genmab, right, with their CD38. Wow. You know, I mean, this was discovered at a Dutch laboratory very close to the LSB offices. And it was partnered, as you know, with Janssen, the J&J. Look at what that has done so far. And look, I mean, it's approved now in the refractory setting, but also in second line, they put out some amazing data. This really is about patient benefit. And now they're doing all these combination studies. Some have already read out with very strong results. You know, it's things like that that get me excited. That's in oncology. And that's, you know, that's Darzalex, right? The CD38 antibody. That's interesting. But look at other areas as well. Look at cell therapy. All these things that are being done there. Look at regenerative medicine. Look at, I mean, there's just too much. I don't know where to start. And we're in a privileged position that, as a firm, LSP sees a lot of these things at a pretty early stage, all the way up to publicly traded companies, right? So through our meetings with companies, but also our interactions with experts, we have this privilege of being on the forefront of seeing a lot of new things. And if you look at areas of highest unmet need, take, for example, well, whatever neurology indication you want to pick as another example. The unmet need,
Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer's, absolutely. But also Parkinson, you name it, right? Refractory epilepsy, amazing. And take for example, I mean, Alzheimer is tough, as we know. All the phase three so far have been very mixed. And we'll see. I think the beta amyloid theory, we'll see what happens. But there's other approaches as well. But take, for example, epilepsy, refractory epilepsy. Again, that's a UK company in this case, GW Pharma, which is coming up with a treatment option for these very, very sick kids who have tried everything. They're highly refractory to all the epileptic medication. They've come up with a cannabinoid-derived molecule, which actually in phase three studies has shown to be, you know, to have a very significant effect in that very refractory population. And these are kids who sometimes have seizures like 10 or more per day, right? So you can imagine that that's also for the parents, it's completely debilitating. These are not incremental things. And, you know, again, it all comes back that, in my opinion, the quality of science and scientific know-how and expertise is excellent in Europe, fortunately. And we're seeing some examples of where that is popping up. But, you know, just too much to cover in a short call. I'm highly enthusiastic about a lot of the innovation that we're seeing currently.
Well, your enthusiasm and excitement are palpable, and of course, there's a great deal to cover, but clearly you're painting a horizon that is quite exciting and relatively short term. We're going to see, you know, great advances in not too distant future.
Bear in mind that I also know very well what the attrition rates in our industry are, so I'm not trying to paint overly rosy picture. There'll be attrition in these studies, and this is still biology and medicine, and things will work, other things will not. But if you ask me about the pipeline of potential innovation and things that may make it to patients one day, you're absolutely right, highly enthusiastic.
Well, venture capitalists have to have a certain appetite for failure as well, right? As part of the game.
we better, yeah.
Well, these are all the questions for today, Dr. Myers. Really inspiring conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.